Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. Try to think back to the year 2007. That was the year when the first iPhone was released. What kind of phone did you have? Did you even have a cell phone at that point? Was your computer a desktop or a laptop? You might have still had an analog TV. Now look around. What kind of electronics do you have? Do you have a tablet or a tiny laptop? Does your phone function as a mini computer? Do you read books on paper or via Kindle? Do you even receive a paper newspaper anymore, or do you read all of your news online? Thinking about the changes in technology in our own daily lives can help us to think about the changes that have come to the classroom. I remember film strips and reel-to-reel films and recorders from my student days, which morphed into VHS tapes and cassettes, remember those? And eventually CDs and DVDs, and then the first computers when I was a teacher. Now I hear my 8th grade son and my teacher education students talk about iPads and Chromebooks and cows carts at school. I couldn't teach anymore at all without a laptop or a projector. Here to help us sort through modern technology and teaching are a group of Kenosha Unified School District professionals who teach children and train teachers to use technology in the classroom. Annie Fredrickson is the current coordinator of instructional technology and library media for the Kenosha Unified School District. Prior to her 15 years at the district level, she served as an instructional technology teacher leader for Lance and Mahone Middle Schools. Annie's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her graduate degree is from National Lewis University, and her administrative certification is from Cardinal Stritch University. Welcome, Annie.
Hello.
Mary Solani has been an instructional technology teacher consultant for over 20 years in KUSD. Prior to teaching in Kenosha, she was a high school business education teacher in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and Gurnee, Illinois. When Mary first moved to the Kenosha community, she worked as a trainer for Advantage Bank. She earned her bachelor's degree from Northern Michigan University and her graduate degree from National Lewis. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Jessica Felton has been an instructional technology teacher consultant in Kenosha for the past 5 years, although this is her 15th year in education. Prior to her current position at the district level, Jessica worked as a classroom teacher at Frank Elementary and at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, a math specialist in the Franklin School District, and as a classroom teacher and math specialist, and as a classroom teacher and reading first coordinator at the 21st Century Preparatory School in Racine. Jessica earned her bachelor's degree in sociology from UW-Madison, her teaching certification from Cardinal Stritch, and her master's degree from Peru State College. Nice to have you here, Jessica.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And last but not least, Shane Gale is the current principal at Pleasant Prairie Elementary School. Prior to 10 years at Pleasant Prairie, he served as an assistant principal at Mahone Middle School and was a former teacher at Reuther High School. He's a graduate of Marquette University and received his graduate degree and certification from Cardinal Stritch. Welcome.
Hello, Karen.
So I want to begin by asking Annie Fredrickson to describe the scope of your work. What kinds of technology and programs are offered throughout the Kenosha School District?
Well, Karen, our department work is focused on enhancing the instructional technology that our teachers use in the classrooms and in the libraries. And we provide professional learning opportunities to improve that use of the digital tools and resources. Those tools bring relevant and current and accurate information to all of our learning activities. In our efforts to be what we call Future Ready, which is a national movement of thousands of districts and their leaders in transforming their schools, we use the ISTE standards, and those are international standards for educators and students to guide our work. You know, the ideal outcome is that students will be empowered learners, great digital citizens, knowledge constructors, innovative designers, computational thinkers, creative communicators, and global collaborators, all through the use of technology. All of our schools have digital devices for both classroom and lab use. Our libraries are outfitted with digital devices as well for access before, during, and after school hours. And many of our classrooms use interactive boards or panels to facilitate engaging learning activities.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So, Mary, tell me a little bit about how technology has changed in the classroom over the years.
Well,
I was just in a third grade classroom today working with the students as they were learning to keyboard, and they mentioned that the first typewriter was developed here in Kenosha by Robert Scholes. So that's part of their third grade unit. So technology for Kenosha really has some deep roots. And I started teaching in business education at the high school level. And at that time, my computers in my classroom were really basically the only computers in the building, and there were six large desktop computers that we shared with 30 students. So today, we have much better access. We have Chromebooks in many of our classrooms. We either have a COW, which we call Computer on Wheels, that will have maybe a set of 30 Chromebooks or desktop laptop computers that students have access to. They may share among a wing in a school building or classroom, or some classrooms have their own set. So access, I would say, has certainly changed since I started. Mm-hmm. It was a lot different when you had six high school students standing around one computer doing a block move of text versus copy and paste on your own today.
That's right. Do you have any sense of what those desktop computers used to cost? It was a lot, wasn't it?
Well, I'll tell you this. One of my first experiences when I started this job, my oldest son was like in seventh grade, and he had a friend that was pretty good with computers, and I came home one day from work, and he had taken out the hard drive of a Apple 5200, which I took out a loan for. I think it was like $1,800. And I said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "We're adding more hard drive, Mom." And I hadn't even paid for this desktop computer. And at that time, I realized that there certainly was a difference between their attitudes towards technology. They were not afraid of it, and they were sure that they could remove that hard drive, replace it with a better one, and it would work. No questions asked, and guess what? It worked.
Oh, good. So there's a happy ending. That's
very
good
happy
to know.
Ending. But creative children, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Right. It is sort of amazing when you think about just how quickly all of this has moved. It used to be a big thing to have a DVD player in your classroom. I remember that was like a huge thing, and now everybody can just play one right off of their computer or just stream video or whatever. So, Shane, as a building principal, how do you lead the growth of instructional technology in your building?
Karen, I've always felt that if we want to prepare students for the next generation, we must equip them with the skills and technology now. In order to do that, we ourselves as adults and as teachers must be confident in the use of the technology that we're looking for. I not only champion that cause, I'm very comfortable with the technology, but I also know we need to invest in both the skills and the equipment to do so. As a leader, we must lead. And the schools that I found out that the principals are very comfortable with technology or tech savvy have schools that reflect the same atmosphere. I take it upon myself and my staff to try new things. I've also encouraged them to do things that they already do well, but better with the use of the tools of technology. It may be with staff development, it may be with teacher websites, it may be with new programs for students, team sharing of ideals, or just basic methods of communications between staff and students and parents. This also comes through the investment of teaching teachers how to best use the technology in the classroom for educational efficiency, for communication, as I stated, or as professional use. An example of this, I think, was pretty clear, was Kenosha Unified School District teams up with Google to offer a Google Summit. It happened this summer. It also mm-hmm. happened last summer. I took a team last summer. I took even a larger team this year because I just feel like it was worth the investment of giving the tools to teachers to use and to build their confidence and their confident level in terms of their comfort for using tools of technology in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have to worry about people that are a little resistant, or is that kind of done now? Most people are kind of ready to embrace technology.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
It's easy to invest in the teachers who are most comfortable with technology, but it's most critical to get the teachers who are least comfortable with technology to get them mm-hmm. in that realm. So sometimes you want to target those teachers first because we've got to get them over that hurdle.
Mm-hmm. See. So, Jessica, how do the teachers keep up? And how helpful are tech-savvy students sometimes in troubleshooting new hardware or software?
Well, in Kenosha Unified, we're actually very fortunate. We have instructional technology teachers at the middle and high schools and instructional technology teacher consultants that split their time between several elementary schools and also support the middle and high school instructional technology teachers. So these educators work with teachers across the district as they integrate technology into their classrooms. They can provide training on new equipment like the Promethean panels and on district software programs like the G Suite, which is Google. In addition, many of the teachers keep up on technology tools by going to create their own personal learning networks. They use those to create those through social media to communicate, collaborate, and learn from educators around the world. That can be done at any time, any day, nighttime, daytime, doesn't matter. At the district level, we also offer several two-hour short sessions and 12-hour courses on technology in the evenings and during the summer. All KUSD employees are able to register for and attend these classes. A few of our schools do have technology clubs where the students can help maintain the devices. I know Mahone Middle School has a club of that sort. And just in the regular classroom, students can also assist the teachers as they use programs. They tend to catch on to the technology very quickly and can often help troubleshoot or solve a problem for an unexpected issue that may come up. And the teachers know that they can use their students as a resource for that too. We also do have technology support technicians, or TSTs, at each school and a help desk, and those people can assist with troubleshooting issues, technology issues, when something's not working. They're a go-to.
So I need to go back and ask you a little bit more about a few things that you mm-hmm. mentioned. So Promethean panels, you know, people who've been in the schools in the last 10, I don't know, when did you first get Promethean boards? 10, 15 years? So they probably know what those are if they have had a kid in the schools recently, but what is a Promethean panel?
Sure. Well, the Promethean panel is the next version of the Promethean board. Mm-hmm. So the Promethean board actually is not being made anymore, and the replacement is the Promethean panel. Basically looks like a big electronic TV, flat-screen TV, but it has all the function of the interactive whiteboard, just without the projector. So the visibility is greatly enhanced.
So it's a clearer, it's like the difference between an analog TV and a digital.
It's HDMI. It's okay. Much clearer. It's also a touch screen. It can also function as a tablet too, mm-hmm. so we can add apps to it as well.
Oh, cool.
And it allows for interactive activities to happen in the classroom, and so they can drive learning lessons from that board, and students can respond with devices, and it interacts with the panel for upper level use of it.
Just for listeners, if you haven't ever seen a Promethean board in action, so I can give a good example of something I've seen recently, but then maybe you all can chime in with the ways teachers use them at different levels. So I've been in a biology classroom, a physiology classroom, basically, where they have sort of the picture of the human body system that they're looking at, and then the terms off to the side, and the students can kind of drag and drop them in the right places, or they can write on things, or they can trace through and connect, the digestive system to see where it goes on the Promethean board, or the teacher can do that. So that's just kind of a general thing. If you think about a tablet, it's sort of like a giant tablet that you could use, but they do so many more things. So I want maybe each of you or whoever has a good story can explain how teachers use Promethean boards.
Yeah, a perfect example is what a panel looks like. Is you go to the electronics store and look for the biggest TV you have, and that's what we have in the classrooms. Mm-hmm. It's pretty powerful too, because as Annie said, you can interact with that board with student computers or technology. We had a lesson, for example, one of my third grade classrooms, where the teacher was able to write a prompt on the panel, send it to students, they responded with their computers, send it back to the panel, and then we were able to sort the responses on students by just moving them with your finger.
Mm-hmm. And I just left Bradford High School, and it's funny that you used a biology mm-hmm. example, because this particular biology teacher was very excited to start to use this type of software in her classroom, where she can actually send it to a device and they can send it back. The second step of that assessment piece to ask students what they've learned is they can look at student work, and teachers can query the students, how well do you think this was answered? Mm-hmm. And they can give a yes or a no. So there's a secondary polling option when they use this type of technology. It's a class flow software piece, which is a web browser based that teachers are using to do that. And it's really opened up lots of options for students to interact and really share and exchange their ideas.
I just wanted to point out that with the new panels, you have, I think, 10 students at one time can come up when they're in the Active Inspire software and can be working on the panel at the same time. So you can have multiple students working together, collaborating, and sharing their work all at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it really becomes a group activity.
Active Connect.
Active Connect, I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah, I just I want to point out that in every classroom that I've been in where they're using that interactive technology, the engagement of the students is probably at its highest when I compare it to various technologies in the classroom. If you are interacting with it, you have to be involved because the teacher has a teacher portal view of who's turned things in. They've got a count up at the top. There's just so many management pieces that allow them to make sure all of those students are participating in the activity. It also gives the students, you know, some of them are afraid to respond in the classroom because they're not quite certain. Mm-hmm. It gives them that opportunity to respond but not necessarily put themselves completely out there in front of everyone. So it opens up some learning avenues for students that wouldn't typically respond.
Great.
Recently, I was out in Paddock Lake. They had a film Screenagers for Central High School, and it was interesting to listen to their students speak on a panel, and they said the best part of the classroom day is that when they get to interact and share in interactive pieces such as a poll or a quiz. They said it better prepares them for quizzes and, you know, the tests that they need to take, you know, around finals and things like that. And they also feel they like that competitive edge. And so I found that kind of exciting because when you go into a classroom and you see the students interact with this, you feel that energy. And the nicest piece is when you see the teachers get charged up too. So it's like immediate feedback for all of us.
Right. And then you can see if you're polling students, say you're a math teacher, you're polling students about an equation that you're teaching them about, you'll know right away if most of the students have gotten it or not and whether you need to stop and reteach because half of them don't have it or you need to figure out which five aren't getting it and so that you can let the others go on. It is a big advantage to turning in the papers, grading them later, and then figuring out how to do something different the next day as opposed to that very next minute. So I think that's one of the big advantages that I see.
It definitely helps guide the instruction in the classroom.
Right. If everyone gets it and you're ready to move on, you can cover a lot more ground. Or if people don't get it, you don't have to wait till the next day to figure that out. So
it does put learning on display in HD format.
Yes.
So the entire class gets to see the thinking, the responses, and what's going on in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It was the old chalkboard now moved into HD formats.
Right. And because they can all input, the students can all input at once, you don't have to wait for space in the chalkboard and all the rest of that. But yes, that's the other part. So you don't necessarily know who is given that particular answer, so you don't have to be afraid if you're a student. And you can read what other people are thinking. So if you do a poll where it's an open-ended question, then you can sort of see, okay, this person thought this. And I can imagine as a teacher, you could go and say, oh, that's an interesting answer. I wonder how this person arrived at that answer. And then you could ask the class to sort of try to figure that out. Even though it might not be correct, it could still be an interesting, divergent way of thinking that you could kind of figure out by having that technology, which you really can't do if you're just collecting papers because you don't get to look at them all at one time. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. Let me just reintroduce. You are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert. This is Education Matters. This discussion of the work of the Kenosha Unified School District's technology program is archived at WGTD.org. www.edumatters.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Our guests are Annie Fredrickson, who's the current coordinator of Instructional Technology and Library Media for the Kenosha Unified School District, Mary Solani, who has been an instructional technology teacher consultant for over 20 years in KUSD, Jessica Felton, who has been an instructional technology teacher consultant in Kenosha for the past 5 years, and Shane Gale, who is the current principal at Pleasant Prairie Elementary School. So, Annie, inevitably, we need to address the issue of cell phones in the classroom. I'm sure a lot of listeners are interested in that question. First, maybe tell us about how this has changed over the years. At some point, cell phones trickled down from high school age students to middle school and younger. And then how has this affected classroom management? What are the best ways to manage technology that students bring either through school-wide rules, classroom rules, or using them productively, I guess, is another way to think about it.
Well, you know, that's a very big question. Mm-hmm. So let's start with kind of the history. Prior to 2011, they were not allowed in the schools. And in 2011, there was a change made in the policy that allowed under principal approval, teacher and principal approval for specific activities, that use of cell phones in the classroom. You know, our district leadership and our school board both recognize that cell phones can introduce disruptive and distracting challenges in the classroom, but they also understand that these same devices have the potential for learning successes as well. We do have teachers that are connecting with content experts and students that are doing that. They're recording practice presentations and experimental data. They create how-to videos for science experiments or other project-based learning. They utilize phone apps for data collection, or sometimes they use them for polling activities where they don't have a board or specific devices in the classroom. You know, it goes without saying that classroom management is key when utilizing phones. So, you know, some of the things that I've seen teachers use is that they'll say, okay, everybody put your phone on the upper right corner of your desk. We're going to be using them today, but until that point, they remain there so that the teacher can visually see those devices and that they're hands off until they need to use them. That's one strategy. I've seen some other things, and I don't know that if it's occurring in our district yet or not, but you'll see on Pinterest they'll have phone pockets where people put them in as they enter the room, and they're labeled per students, typically in a elementary classroom where there's just all the same students are in there. It does, you know, we do have elementary students that have phones. You know, I went to a digital citizenship presentation at one of our middle schools last month, and the police officer that was doing the program asked how many of you have cell phones. And I would say 95% of the seventh graders in that particular assembly raised their hand. And so the good thing is we're also doing some training with digital citizenship and effective uses and safety measures when you are engaging in conversations via electronic devices. So I hope that answers some of the questions.
Yeah, I mean, that is very interesting. I'm curious, as a elementary school principal, Shane, what do you see with the younger kids? Do any of them have phones? Do many of them?
Yes, I mean, there's going to be students who have phones because parents give them their phones. It's always generally starts off with safety and communication, and then it's geared into a little bit of learning. It's not so much geared at the elementary level of using phones for learning. So we don't see a heavy dose of that, more so when you get to the middle school or the high school. So for us, it's just about managing it, making sure that they're used in the right way. Kids are getting used to programs, apps, social media, so we've got to be very cognizant of teaching them how to use the technology they have in the right way, just in terms of safety as a whole, but not so much for learning because they are so young still.
Right. I do tell my students that we used to text each other in class when I was a kid. It was just that we wrote the notes on paper. We'd fold them up, try to pass them around the room without the teacher seeing. So it's not completely unprecedented, but I do think it's a slightly different management problem, but it is sort of the same thing. The issue is, if students are distracted by their phones, what else is going on in the classroom that may or may not be engaging them? And so you have to sort of think through that, right?
What's nice is when we introduce phones in the classroom, too, you can have those conversations with students as far as appropriate use of phones. And it's interesting because many times our children will repeat things in such a way that they teach us such valuable lessons. They talk about how their parents are on their phones all the time, and, you know, they're on the computer first thing. And so I think all of us learn from each other when we think about how we're using technology today, because it certainly can connect us, and work is a very collaborative tool. But I also think we need to use it with integrity and have those human relationships and conversations that sometimes don't include that technology. So that's part of what we do. It's the balance. And so when we talk about technology integration, it's about using technology as a tool to better our life, not necessarily have that distraction of losing personal relationships or loss of time because we're playing Scrabble or Solitaire 24/7.
Right, or Tetris.
Or Tetris.
That was
or
the thing that got me when I was younger.
You know, Mary brought up a good point in that it's the adults, too. So even at our administrative meetings or our professional meetings that we have, we build in, we have to build in time for the participants to check their email because we've pulled them sometimes from their buildings, and we realize the importance of that communication, but we also want them to be engaged with what the content of the meeting is. So sometimes we have these quick check breaks, and so we build in strategies to honor the need for that communication to happen, but also say, as Shane says, how do you use it appropriately?
Right. I think one of the other things that maybe some of our listeners that don't have children currently don't realize is that there really aren't any payphones anywhere anymore. So if you want your child to be able to do extracurricular things and be able to contact you to get picked up or whatever, there's no other way to do it. I mean, you can go to the office when it's open, but there aren't payphones in the lobby anymore the way there were when I was in high school and middle school, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, if you have a family of three, four, five different people, everybody's going in every different direction. And the easiest way to keep up with people is through their cell phone. So people are always on the go. People are involved in many different things. Students are in sports. They're in clubs after school. They've got jobs. And so there's many things that have happened. And the cell phone is a viable and useful tool to communicate amongst family. It's just a matter of when you communicate and how you communicate, and that it doesn't become a hindrance to what you're learning.
So true.
Yeah, that is true. So all of our listeners are also taxpayers. So on their behalf, I have to ask, how do we pay for all of this technology? Does some of it save money for the district? And then what happens to the old stuff? Does it get reused, or how does this whole thing work, Annie?
Well, we definitely have a plan for technology acquisition in the district. Each year, principals review their current inventory and plan out the needs for the next 3 years. They do get an allocation from my department on refreshing their retired devices. And some of the schools combine my dollars or my department dollars with their building funds or maybe some grant funds to maybe enhance the purchases that they're making. But we do use all technology until it can no longer run on its maxed operating system. And if there's shifting that can happen, let's say it's no longer needed at one school, we're very good about communicating to another school saying, hey, we've got some. Our technicians will take retired devices and strip them down for parts, so we use those pieces. You know, when we do the large refresh each year where we're purchasing devices to replace, we do a bid out to the vendors so that we're getting reduced prices for larger purchases. We try to consolidate those to get the best price possible, always.
One thing I noticed recently is my son's middle school, instead of signing a sheet when you go in, you type your name into the computer,
yes.
Which seems like, oh, you know, computers have to be more expensive than paper. But what used to happen with the paper lists is that they had to be typed into a database so that you could keep track of where all the students were and which visitors came to the building. So there were person hours devoted to typing all those lists and trying to figure out people's handwriting that you don't have to do anymore because there are computers to check in with. So I suppose on some level, like any kind of automation, some of those things just sort of happen. I would imagine in the school libraries, this makes a huge difference, right?
They do utilize digital sign-ins for students, especially at the high schools, mm-hmm. where they're coming in throughout the day. You know, sometimes they'll see, you know, several hundred students in one day, and they keep track of why the students are coming in and pass information. And so all that data is really important. So they'll take an inexpensive device mm-hmm. and use that for the signing in. And I am actually seeing it at other districts as I go to meetings within our region, that they also are using those as the sign-in pieces. Mm-hmm. And even for security purposes, that data being readily available, who's in your building, mm-hmm. when did they arrive, and sometimes they ask other identifying questions. So right. I think it's a good move.
Okay. So one of the things that I always am curious about is one of the things we were told when the whole technology revolution first started was that we were going to use less paper. Do you remember? And then what happened, I think, or at least this happened to me, was that I was able to print drafts so quickly because I wasn't having to retype everything that I ended up using a lot more paper for a while. But now I sort of feel like we've finally gotten to the point where we can share documents online and multiple users can add to them, such as the Google Doc we use to make this list of questions today. So what do you think about this? Are we using more or less paper, or do you actually have some way of measuring that? Is there some savings in buying and disposing of excess paper that we are seeing?
I mean, I can speak on behalf of an elementary school. I mean, we're always going to use paper as long as we're producing work from students. So that doesn't necessarily change. The way that we do it, and maybe to get to the final product, we can save paper, such as a Google shared document, for example, can save five pieces of paper by putting it on one. For adults, I mean, if you can imagine an email being a communication that I can save, file, and store versus a handwritten note, that's saving me thousands of pieces of paper alone and stamps. But all being said and done, I mean, you're going to see some of it, but as long as we're still having students produce things and possibly save things, you're going to have a use of paper, but I think it will come in time because more and more is being changed to a digital format.
Mm-hmm. And again, that student choice, there are still some that prefer paper. Mm-hmm. So various mediums, we try to pay attention to that a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm. I'll say with Google. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say with Google, too. Right before I came here, I was in a second grade classroom, and they were publishing their acrostic poems that they had written for fall, and we actually did those through Google. They typed them up in a Google Doc and got to format them and change the font and size, which is always super fun with second grade. And then they actually turned them into their teacher through Google Classroom. So there was no paper involved at all. And then we modeled for them. This was their first time in Google Classroom, but the teacher was able to comment on their work and send that comment directly back to each student. Mm-hmm. So all of that was done without any paper. And we can also use different online quizzes. Google has a forms feature that we can make online quizzes through, and there are other programs that allow the same thing. So that can minimize some of the paper consumption as well.
Mm-hmm. I definitely believe in the secondary level that's happening. You know, when they're doing, especially in the English classes, they can start their drafts and go, they're not printing every time they have to do a draft for the English teacher, they can turn it in through what she said is Google mm-hmm. Classroom, or they could be in a shared folder, and the teacher doesn't have to lug all those papers home to correct them. All the commenting can happen within that document, and it's interesting, when we switched to Chromebooks, we had some issues with printing. Mm-hmm. So as the Chromebooks were increasing, the printing challenges were increasing, and It's funny now, we don't even get people asking us to look at that printing option anymore with Google. They're publishing in different ways. They're sharing on school Facebook pages with parents if they're creating some things. The sharing of the product, as Shane was talking about, it's paper if it's going up on the walls in their building or it's going home to parents, but sometimes it's in a digital environment as well.
Mm-hmm.
As teachers, we don't have all the binders that we once had.
Yes.
So that's delightful.
I tried to explain to my students what it was like to teach social studies back before the internet, where you had binders full of blank maps in case you needed a map mm-hmm. of a certain area for people to, mm-hmm. you know, and then you'd make copies of the maps for them to do map work or whatever. Yes, that was mm-hmm. That was something. I'm wondering, do you see a move toward e-books? At the college level, we are sort of in between. I thought we would have already kind of gone wholeheartedly for e-books, but there are a lot of people who don't prefer them. So it's still an option for us. Do you use many of them at the high school level? Or
I'll speak from the curriculum end. We do now, as we do adoptions for our content areas, it usually has some kind of a digital component. I don't know that we're often seeing that it's a lesser cost as opposed right. to the textbook, right? But really all of the company or vendors that provide options for us in that process, they all have digital components. So the challenge comes with students having access to a device for it to be strictly ebook or digital. We're not at that place yet, so mm-hmm. we have families that don't have internet at home, and we have a challenge with all students having access to digital devices on a daily basis. So mm-hmm. we can't quite move that way 100%, but we're doing the best that we can with access and utilizing the digital tools, whether it be on site or having access before and after school. E-books in our libraries are definitely expanding. So mm-hmm. That is a definite growth for us in that department.
Accessibility. E-books are very nice as far as text-to-speech for students that may be visually impaired or struggle with reading. That's most helpful. And mm-hmm. so I think that's really something we strive for when we look at content and textbook adoptions.
Right. There's even a special font that is sort of weighted near the bottom of the letters
dyslexia.
For dyslexic students.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
It helps with the letters not turning around when they look at them on the page. So, yeah, that's another one of those things we didn't even talk about before. Thank you for bringing that up, that
yes.
there's a lot of
so
lot
accessibility
of things,
is
yeah.
it's key, especially for personalized learning. So mm-hmm. everyone gets to show their strengths. So if you're auditory learners, and it's wonderful.
Right. So as a teacher educator, I'm always interested in the paths people take to get into teaching or into education in general. So can you each tell us about how you ended up teaching in your field and the preparation you did in order to become a teacher, and specifically a teacher of technology? Jessica?
Sure. I come from a family of educators, so teaching was not in my sights initially. I went to school at UW-Madison and graduated with a degree in sociology. Didn't really get a job in that field. Went to work for a company that managed retirement plans. And after doing that for a little while, I just decided this isn't what I want to do. Kind of talked with my dad a little bit more. And when I went to my first clinical experience for the teaching program, I knew that that was what I was meant to do. So mm-hmm. it was just like, okay, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. So I went back to school at night and worked during the day. It took about 3 years or so at Cardinal Stritch, and I got my teaching certification. And then I went and taught in the classroom for a few years, and then I enrolled in my master's program, which was actually done all online, mm-hmm. Which was kind of new and innovative at that time. And I didn't know what to expect, but I learned a lot, and I had the degree is in curriculum and instruction, but I had an instructional technology certification along with that. And so that kind of led me to this position that I'm in now.
Mm-hmm. Great. Mary?
Well, my mom was a librarian, so she used to set up the parochial high schools in my city where I grew up. And I used to tag along, and sometimes she would have me, put away books and file the catalog cards at that time and put the little cards on the little poles in the drawers, and that's what I can remember when I was small. And then the teachers coming in, and it was a warm environment, I think. And then when I was in high school, I went to school in downtown city, and my father's office was down there, and after school I worked for him in business. And then I thought for sure I was going to go into business when I went to college, and I think just some of my instructors that I had kind of mentored me along, and I kind of decided to major then in education, business education, and I kind of gravitated, I guess, to technology a long time ago.
Shane?
I initially entered college with an interest in anthropology, and that was my first degree. But that kind of morphed into the concept of teaching anthropology and history and social studies. So I picked up an education major as well. I spent a lot of time in classrooms, a lot of time working with students and teachers, and that led me down to a path of teaching high school initially, and that took it from there. So I've been in education for 20 years, starting from those concepts of the classroom, and just never left.
And Annie?
I, too, began my studies in an alternate field and worked my first 4 years at Abbott. I quickly realized that environment was not for me, and my love was with education, and so I went back to pursue those certifications. Just landed in technology, so.
Okay. We have time for just one story about a student before we say farewell. Does someone have a really good one that they can share about sort of technology changing the life of one of your students?
I remember working in a high school in April, and we worked on a digital book project where they were creating a children's book for an elementary school across town about the American Revolution, which is challenging in itself to make the American Revolution a children's book. And we also created videos, and the work that the students put in outside of class was kind of exciting because they actually would build boats, and they were in bands, and they would record their own songs, and it was a very fun activity. And yet the learning was taking place, and it just kind of happened. And it was like my last day that I was in the class, and this young boy came up, and he was from Israel, and he had been at this school since the beginning of the year, and he said, I just want to thank you because I really made friends during this project. And to me, that just speaks volumes, because when you sit in classes and you're not doing a lot of group things, you assume these kids all know each other, and yet they don't, and especially someone new to the school. So to me, that was just a real feel-good that why we do collaborative projects and, you know, why we mix these kids up to work together and teach them to work alongside each other, that they form these friendships that can last forever.
Well, that's an excellent note to end on. You've been listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the work of the Kenosha Unified School District's technology programs is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again there, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in the discussion there. Thank you, Annie Fredrickson, Mary Solani, Jessica Felton, and Shane Gale.
Welcome. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Bye.